date is the 11th of February. We are in Bletchley Park, Large Grove. The name of the interviewers are Simon Starton and Marigold Hughes. The name of the interviewee is Tom Winter, and the interview is for the grandchildren of the Blitz Project.
Okay. Well, let's start, Tom, with what you started telling us a moment ago about what is your memories of the first day of the Blitz, Black Saturday, as it's called.
Yeah, the Black Saturday, 7th of September, 1940.
Yeah.
Can I, just before that time, Simon, I would like to explain that a year before, after what they call the Phony War from 1939, us kids didn't really understand what war was all about at all. Except, of course, we were sent away from home.
Yeah.
We were sent evacuation to, of all places, our government sent us, London Children was on the south coast. We was at Brighton.
You went to Brighton.
10 months.
Yeah.
But I know many of my friends and neighbours went to Hastings, went to even Dover, believe it or not. But after the fall of France, when our forces were trapped at Dunkirk, immediately after that, Mum and Dad, in their wisdom, decided to come down to Brighton and take us back.
Mm-hmm.
And at Brighton was myself, my late brother Joe, my late sister Ivy, and Barbara, who's still alive. She lives in Bexhill-on-Sea now. Mum brought us home, I think, about 1 week before the Blitz, so it would be the late August, the last week in August. We were brought back from Brighton to London, and then I remember that week was quite hectic because we had been at Brighton, we hadn't been fitted, us children, hadn't been fitted with the customary gas mask that all children were being subjected to. And if anything was frightening, I think, at that time, for me anyway, it was that moment. Going to the school and being fitted with a gas mask, you know, it was an apparatus that I just couldn't comprehend.
Yeah. Never actually used either, was it?
Never used, no. So 1 week later, I can remember we did have an air raid on September the 6th, on the Friday night, and the sirens went, and there was an interval of 2, 3, 4 hours, and then the all clear went. But I can't remember any aircraft or any guns or any noise whatsoever taking place on the Friday night. On Saturday, being a shopping day for our dear mum, about 3 o'clock, she always used to tell one or other of us children, I'm going shopping. If there's an air raid sounded, I want you to go into the shelter. But before you do, lock the dog in the bedroom and shut the door. And in case of smoke, you know, if there's a fire. But remember, she's in there. And go to the shelter. Then Mum did a shopping expedition and went round to Surrey Docks Station, which I think was about a mile away, mile and a half away. And it was while she was shopping, about 4:30, 4:45, I can remember the wail of sirens going. And of course, we complied to Mum's instructions and we headed for the shelter within the flats in the corner of Holyoke House. And I think we was in that shelter something like an hour, and we could hear quite a lot of activity going on outside our immediate shelter. And I was very nosy as a little boy. I wanted to see aeroplanes. I wanted to see Spitfires flying above, but I'd go to the small window, a small window in the shelter that one could look out. And against the wishes of some of the men in there, come away from that window, you know, something will hit you. And I said, there's a lot of smoke going on outside, you know, there are fires, and the raid intensified. And I think it was about 20 minutes, half an hour later, there was so much smoke, and outside was lit up in an orange glow. Very, very unusual and quite frightening then. And they decided that it was time that we left the air raid shelter and had to make an escape. Because where Holyoke House was situated, it was there was only one exit, one entry and one exit. There was no other way out because the dock wall was a perimeter of three quarters of Holyoke House. So there was only one exit, one escape road down Bryan Road. Bryan Road was a road only about 50 yards, 70 yards long. And on the right-hand side was the church wall of the Holy Trinity Church. And on the left was a fencing, which was a perimeter fence of the convent. There was a convent there where nuns and young girls used to be in there, you know, working there. And I can remember we was at the top of the street in Holyoke, in the square of Holyoke House. And the firemen were actually in the road spraying water onto the church and water onto the convent. Mm-hmm. So there was fire on our left and there was fire on our right. And it looked almost impassable. How the hell are we going to get through there? Because it was getting very hot now.
Yeah.
And the firemen, seeing our predicament, actually lowered their hoses against the wall on our right.
Yeah,
and whatever they did with the hoses, as the wall, as the spray of the water hit the wall, it ricocheted back out, forming an archway of water.
Yeah,
and we, something like 100 people, 150 people, went through that till we actually hit Rotherhithe Street, about 70 yards further on. They intended then to take us across the river on a pontoon, on a boat, you know, by the pontoon bridge. Yep. And as we were all gathering up on this pontoon bridge, something happened. I think another bomb had come and that got destroyed. So that escape route from Rotherhithe had gone. And we was back into Rotherhithe Street and then made our way westwards along Rotherhithe Street towards Rotherhithe Tunnel. And as we was travelling along Rotherhithe Street, the volume of people was increasing. Almost every 50 yards, more people joined this exodus of people as they was leaving their houses. We went past Ordnance Wharf, which is near Acorn Walk, and a lot of people were joining our column of people, and that's when we met Dad. And Dad assured us that we would all be okay, that he would find out where Mum was, and we were all going to a school. I don't think Dad ever mentioned the name of the school. He said, you're going to a school in Bermondsey just for the night. He says, until such times we can find you and you'll be okay. So you carry along with the people. Then he said to George, my oldest brother, your brothers and sisters are here, where's the dog? And George went, I've left her in the flat, Dad. I'll go back for her. And immediately George ran back, and then we didn't see George anymore that night. I'll just explain George's story at this moment. Georgie left us, got to the bottom of Bryan Road, and by this time our flats were really an inferno. Mm. And the fireman asked George what he was doing coming back, and he said, our dog is trapped in one of the bedrooms. And I said, don't you worry about that. You carry on to where your brothers and sisters have gone. We'll get the dog and we'll locate you at a later date. We'll save your dog. Sadly, it would turn out that they were not able to do that.
Yeah.
Our dear Fluff was the casualty of the Winter family. He died. George, in the meantime, had met two of his friends, Stanley Williams and Lenny Dwan, and they said, George, we're making our way to the school, to our family. You're going to come along with us? And he said, no, I'm going to try to go the other way, around Redriff Road, to Surrey Docks, where Mum is. I'm looking for her. They said, OK, we'll see you later. Sadly, it would turn out that even Len Dwan and Stanley Williams sustained so bad injuries in Keaton's Road School, where the Rotherhithe people had sadly gone, and I think a week later they both died. I think it was the following morning on Sunday, about 8 o'clock, that Mum rejoined her family, us, where we were sheltering with Mrs. Elliot, with her sister in Southwark Park Road somewhere, and we were all reunited.
Yeah.
Do you want me to continue?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think George was fortunate in finding Mum at Surrey Docks, and of course he enlightened her. She was terribly worried because, though there wasn't, in them days, Simon, there were no mobile phones, there wasn't many telephones, let alone mobile phones, but the grapevine, as it was in them days, by word of mouth, you know, from shelter to shelter, from street to street, within an hour, all those at Surrey Docks learned, all those in Bermondsey, I suppose, had learned about the disaster at Keaton's Road School, where something like 300-400 people had been evacuated to because they'd lost their homes that night. And sadly, I think the figure was something like 68 people perished. And of course, Mum was fearing for our lives, our own children, but was enlightened by George, of course, that told Mum that we'd gone to a Mrs. Elliot, our neighbour, where we was reunited. I think the Sunday morning we was taken to our Aunt Mary's, who lived up by Great Dover Street, near the Bricklayers Arms. We stayed there just for one night, mostly in the shelter, in their shelter, because the Germans was piling it on again the following night on September 9th. And it was, I think, the Monday that we all made our way with Mum and us five children to our grandmother's house at Catford. She lived in Perry Hill, Catford. And where Gran, a few days before, was living, she was a widow at the time, of course, she was living predominantly on her own with her cat. And then suddenly she's got Mum, my mother, and five of us children, and my Aunt Lil, who'd been also been bombed out in Southwark that on a Saturday night, with her two children. So there was Gran with quite a household now. I believe we were at Gran's for about 3 weeks. It must have now been about October 18, I think, when in the course of that night, we had a bomb, £1,000 bomb, we were told, drop in our garden, almost on our own shelter, and we were all fortunate to survive that, because our shelter actually was on the edge of the bomb crater.
Yeah.
You didn't want me to go into detail about that, as I explained earlier.
We'll come back to that maybe in a bit.
And then, of course, at the same time all this was happening, my dad, back in Rotherhithe, was popping back daily to our old bombed out house to see if any mail, if there was any news, And what postmen used to do in them days, Simon, though the house was derelict and empty because of the bombing, they would throw the mail in the passageway. I think this was an accepted thing in them days, that the owners of the house would return every so often to see, try to retrieve something that they used to have, you know, that might be usable, because things were hard to come by in them days, furniture and everything. So they would go back to try to retrieve things, and also they would look for their, if they, yeah. they had any postcards.
Yeah.
And Dad, of course, went back several times to number seven Holyoke House to see if there was any news from Harry. And I always remember Dad saying, when he got there, this is whilst we was at Grand's, he got to Holyoke House and saw two orange envelope telegrams, and they were quite ominous. To see an orange envelope, yeah. that was bad news. And I always remember my late dad, he said, I was almost crying, you know, with the thought that probably something terrible had happened. And he picked the two telegrams up and he opened the first one and he read, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Winter, we are glad to inform you that Harry is now safe and will be home with you forthwith."
Mm-hmm.
War Office, whatever. And of course, Dad broke down then, but he was pleased rather than...
relief, yeah.
And he opened the second telegram and it read, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Winter, we are sorry to inform you that your son has been reported missing at sea. If we hear any news, we'll contact you at a later date." So inadvertently, Dad had opened the best telegram first.
Yeah.
He'd read the best message first.
Yeah, and then...
And the worst one second, yeah. which was a good thing. So when he come to Mum, of course, he just said, "Harry's okay. He's going to be home shortly, but he has been torpedoed."
Yeah.
"But I'm sending you now to... Leicester, you're going to evacuation. You know, Mum and the five children, you're all going to Leicester. And when Harry comes home, I'll send him up to see you."
Yeah.
The following day, I can remember, there was once again a journey across to St Pancras Station and up to Leicester. We were going from pillar to post in the war years, been bombed out twice in a month.
Yeah.
And we arrived in Leicester. And I can remember Mr. and Mrs. Addis, I think their name were. No, it wasn't, it was Keating. I'm sorry. It was Mr. and Mrs. Keating. And of course they were concerned and they were quite lovely people. And on the first night they said to Mum, "You won't have to worry about a shelter here. We've had the sirens go, but we've had no actual air raids. No trouble whatsoever." And Mum said, "Irrespective of that, we'd like to sleep downstairs tonight. We're not going upstairs." So I said, "Where can you sleep downstairs?" And she said, "We'll sleep under the stairs. That's where we'll sleep."
Mm.
And he said, "You can't all get in there." She said, "We've got in tighter situations than this."
Yeah.
She said, "We'll go under the stairs." So Mum and us five children went under the stairs. That was our bed and shelter for the night. And the sirens did sound at 10 o'clock, and by 10:15 there was an almighty noise going on outside, and the Germans had decided they now wanted to attack Leicester. And that was the terrible night, I think, that Leicester, Coventry, the Midlands really copped it that night. And when the bombs started falling in Leicester, looking back now, I suppose it sounds a bit funny, but Mr. and Mrs. Keeping were down and they wanted to join us under the stairs. They did realise that Mum was a good judge, and they understood why she was so terrified of sleeping upstairs. And I think it was the following day that my dear brother Harry had made his way up from London under Dad's instructions to see his mum and his brothers and sisters, and let them know that he was home and he had survived. And Harry stayed that first night. We had another terrible air raid in Leicester. And the following day, Harry said, "Mum, I'm going to go back to London. I'm going to live in the air raid warden's post with Dad." He said, "I could stay there for the night." And Mum says, "And when you go back to London tomorrow, Harry, I'm coming back to London with your brothers and sisters. And Harry said, Mum, Dad will be quite displeased with this. She said, I don't care what Dad feels. And there was a saying in them days, it sounds strange, silly really. Mum said, if I'm going to die with my family, I'm going to die in my own place. I want to die in Bermondsey. It's not made any difference where you die, but yeah. It made a difference to Mum.
Yeah.
And the following day, there's Dad expecting Harry to come along to put up in the air raid warden's post. His colleagues had agreed, yeah, you can squeeze Harry in, you know, in his bed, he can sleep here. And then suddenly, as well as Harry, there was Mum and five other children.
Yeah.
So they had to rethink things, but we did stay in the air raid warden's post, I remember, up until Christmas 1940. And I know it was Christmas time because the pub next door, at Ordnance Wharf, they were still singing and dancing, you know, even though it was in the height of war, they were still enjoying themselves. Yeah. And then, of course, we were eventually rehoused in the March, I think, 1941, into Redruth Estate, where we lived for the rest of the war.
Yeah. Very good. How did you, I mean, from a child's perspective, there's a child's perspective and then there's your parents' perspective. How do you think your mum and dad coped during that period?
Very, very difficult. Dad naturally was terribly worried, as any loving parent would be. Dad with his family, you know, not knowing from one day to the next if whilst he was at work or on duty, if his family would get hurt in an air raid. And likewise, whilst Dad was out in the air raid, you know, as air raid wardens did, there was no sort of going to bed. They was on active duty throughout the night as well as their day job.
Yeah.
I don't know, they must have got some respite by just having a doze every hour or so, you know. But yeah, mums and us as kids, we used to worry about Dad being out in the air raids. But we were thankful that as a family of a mum and a dad and six children, we all came through it with no visible scars, except, of course, the memory of the frightening experience that we did endure throughout the Second World War.
Yeah.
Incidentally, my old mum, she was always proud. Mum died in 1998 in Rotherhithe.
Mm-hmm.
Mum was always proud that in her household she had four sons, a husband, and two girls. And each one of her male relatives, Dad, Harry, George, and Joe, and myself, we were all in the armed forces between the years of 1940 to 1947.
Mm-hmm.
We all served, you know.
She was proud of that.
Yeah, but of course, I was that much younger, so I went into the army as the war just after the war ended in 1947. But both Harry and George were on active service in the Royal Navy, and Dad, of course, went into the army. And Joe, my late brother, just 2 years older than me, he served in the Royal Navy just before the war ended. So I was always quite proud that the Winters family did their share.
Did their bit, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, how did you keep your spirits up during the war? And how did you entertain yourselves? And
well, music was and always has been quite a major part of the Winter family. I always believe that. I've loved music for as long as I can remember. Way back when Harry went overseas after he was torpedoed in 1940, Harry joined the Royal Navy in 1942. He put his age up, he shouldn't have done.
Mm-hmm.
He put his age up, he wasn't 18 quite, but he didn't have to serve until he was called up. But he joined the Royal Navy, and whilst he was away, Harry put in my care his treasured Bing Crosby records.
Oh dear, yeah.
And I can remember I used to go down the air raid shelters with my friends. This is not during an air raid, this is during the afternoon. And we used to take over that, and we used to have little concerts down there, musical concerts in the shelter at Redriff Estate, and play music to ourselves. And I can remember, do you know, I'm always proud, I've always had a love for Americans. I think it's because I used to meet so many American seamen in the docks, and I've told so many stories and written so many stories about my association with young men from the United States during the war years. And I can always remember, because I loved Americans so much and I loved singing so much, that I had Bing Crosby singing the Star Spangled Banner, the American National Anthem, and I know that word for word correct, and the tune. And God Bless America, and the third tune I always loved was America, I Love You. Probably, Simon, that's why I was so incensed when John F. Kennedy was assassinated way back in 1963, because there's this love. And incidentally, as you know, right where your farm is in Rotherhithe, just behind you've got St. Mary's Church, haven't you?
Yeah.
The famous little St. Mary's Church. Basically the home of the Mayflower. You knew that, of course, you knew that history.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that as a kid.
Yep.
And when I used to talk to American seamen way back 1941, 1942, throughout the Second World War, I'd be talking to them where they come from in the United States, and I was pleased to listen to, you know, where they came from.
Yes.
And then I would say, did you know that your origins were here in Rotherhithe? In Rotherhithe? And I said, yes. The Mayflower, the famous Mayflower in 1620, sailed from less than 400 yards from the spot where I was born at St. Olive's Hospital. That's where I was born. Yeah. And, gee, can you show us? And I think I was the youngest tour agent in Rotherhithe.
I was about
14, 15, I used to take a group of 6, 7, 8 young Americans and said, this is where. And I believe, I said, from the library, they've told me that Christopher Jones, the captain, he's buried in this churchyard. You knew that, Simon, I believe.
I didn't, but
he's buried in the churchyard, as I believe also is John Clark, who was the first mate of the Mayflower, and he was also a Rotherhithe man, I believe.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Especially as the show, we kind of concentrate on Mayflower Street.
Yeah, so it's named after, and after as I say, as many Americans do not know that come to London, probably visit the other city in the West End, and don't know within 2 miles away is where their origins were.
Did you charge them money? Did you make any money out of the Americans?
What they used to do, the Americans, they would get, well, this is another thing, Simon, and I'm going to show you shortly in there.
Yeah.
In 1944, the Americans came into the war, as you know, in 1941 after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And then they started flocking. Their merchant ships was coming to Surrey Docks quite regularly. And I'd come home from school. And I don't know if people's told you that live in Rotherhithe now, probably they don't know. We used to call it the Three Bridges. Do they still use that term?
I've not heard it.
From Surrey Docks.
I've heard it from other people that we've interviewed it, but only not before then.
From Surrey Docks, where Surrey Docks Station is, I don't know, it's where Lower Road is and Redriff Road starts, there used to be a cover, all undercover, a big shed built into the dock wall where all the dockers used to sign on there of a morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sort of 7 o'clock, they would sign on to get distributed all around the docks. That's what they used to get pulled out by different members. You know, so many gangs going to go in that dock, so many gangs going in that dock. And to get back to where we lived right into the heart of Rotherhithe.
Yeah.
There was the Three Bridges. We used to call it, a term used quite regularly to local people was, I'm sorry I'm late, I've got a bridger.
Right.
And a bridger was when one ship had come in from the River Thames and it was negotiating its berthing point within the Greenland or the Baltic yards.
Yeah.
And they had to go across, if you understand, they had to cross the actual roadway.
Yeah.
So a bridge would swing and let a ship go through. And you could be held up for something like 10 minutes, quarter of an hour.
Yeah.
While a merchant ship went slowly through. And remember, they did go through slowly. They was pulled by a tug or winches, you know.
Yeah.
And, and we would get a bridger 2, 3, 4 times a day sometimes.
Yeah.
If I was late for school, which was quite often, I would always tell them, "Sorry, sir, I know winter, you got a bridger." Well, it's true, sir, I got a bridger. And, of course, coming home, I would get bridges.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, Simon, if people in Rotherhithe still remember that terminology, to get a bridger.
Yeah, I mean, I think people who were your age during the Second World War probably would, but I don't think it would be a term that any of the young people would recognise.
No. I can remember my dad. My dad would say, in them days, wireless sets, they didn't operate from a plug in the wall. They wasn't powered by electricity. They was powered by an accumulated system where there was a glass jar of some description that had acids in, and that used to power radios.
Mm-hmm.
And they called it an accumulator. And round Surrey Docks was the accumulator shop. Everyone took their accumulator. And if kids carried them, parents always said, or dads usually, be careful, don't spill that acid on your fingers, because it could burn and damage. And I would get that job invariably. Dad would come home and say, "Thomas, I want you to go, I'm going to have a lay down because I've been on duty all night. I want you to pop round to the accumulator shop round Surrey Docks and get the accumulator, because they use up their power and then they have to be recharged." And I can remember, you couldn't get on a bus. Do people tell you about the famous 82 bus that used to run around town? Yes, there was only one bus route in Rotherhithe in them days. It was a double-decker bus, and it was 82. And that used to go from Amos Estate, eastwards, all the way around the island, till it got to Surrey Docks. Then it would turn right and head towards Rotherhithe Tunnel. And then it would go through Rotherhithe Tunnel to Stepney Branch Road on the opposite side. As you come out of Rotherhithe Tunnel on the Stepney side, on the north side, that was where its route ended.
Yeah.
And it was a regular service. It probably was only a distance of about, top of my head, about 3 miles.
Yeah.
Total distance. But it was a regular service. The old 82 bus. And once again, people would get on the 82 bus and I'd still catch a bridger many, many times. Yeah. You know, people going to work, going to school, get the bridger. Yeah, that was a common occurrence. Two buses I remember in London, quite vivid, three buses. The 82, the number one, and I think the 202. The 202 bus was a bus from Surrey Docks to New Cross Gate.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of them routes still exist.
They've probably been put in inside another route and given a number. Yeah. But it's still in there in some way.
So when you asked me a question earlier, Simon, with regard to the memories of Rotherhithe.
Yeah,
they're vivid memories. Yeah.
Tell us a bit more about the docks, what you remember about the docks.
Most of the men population that lived in Rotherhithe, predominantly, I would say 90% of men, able-bodied men that lived in Rotherhithe, what we call downtown, were dockers. My dad was never a docker. My dad was a caretaker, actually, of Redruth Estate. Is Redruth Estate still in Rotherhithe?
I think it is. It's definitely the school there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. I'll check.
Yeah, my dad was caretaker of that school. But the dock wall. I've told other stories and I'll give you copies of these stories, incidentally, where in 1944, during a flying bomb incident, we had no bread at all in Rotherhithe. Our bakery at Spa Road had been bombed, or had been damaged. And there was no bread available in our shops. And we were talking to some American seamen. We had quite a rough night last night, they was telling us, yeah, we remember that. And we said, we've had no bread today. And they said, why is that? And we said, our bakery got bombed. You guys have had nothing to eat? I said, well, we've had no bread. Okay. They looked at their watches. It was about 1 o'clock. And they says, we're going back to our ship, which was just inside the dock wall from where Redriff Estate was. We're going back to ship. Come on, guys. We're going to do an emergency bake. Be by this dock wall in 2.5 hours, by about 4:30. And I'll always remember about 4:30 this particular afternoon, we were all on the top floor of the balcony at Redriff Estate, looking over the dock wall. We could see the ship about 200-300 yards away. And we saw a dozen Americans coming along with big baskets of loaves of bread that they baked specifically for us hungry children. And this call went out. I don't know if you know that during the war, Americans was known as doughboys.
Okay.
D-O-U-G-H.
Yeah.
As in money. They had plenty of dough.
Yeah.
But to us, they were doughboys.
Yeah.
But the flour type.
Yeah.
And we said, kids, the doughboys are coming. The doughboys are coming. And they reached the dock wall, and from where they were, they was handing the loaves down to us kids, and we was distributing them amongst all the people in the flats. Wasn't that a lovely story?
That is lovely.
And that was a true, true story. Another story I can tell that also during the flying bomb campaign, Hitler was really trying to get the Winter family, you know. He tried very hard, but he didn't succeed, I'm pleased to say. But my dear late sister Ivy, my dad had a bike. It was my dad's pride and joy. Like people have their cars today, my dad's bike was his pride and joy. Not many people had cars, and hardly any people had cars, and a few people had bikes, but dad's bike, and you keep off of it, Thomas. I was always riding the bike when he was asleep during the daytime after night work. And he used to give me specific instructions, and to my mum, make sure he keeps off that bike. And I was at the street door, once again, I was defying his command, I was on his bike. And Ivy was talking to me, my late sister, and she says, Tom, the doodlebugs, they were coming over one every half an hour, every 3/4 hour, you'd get a doodlebug come over. Tom, in which direction do the flying bombs come from? I mean, from the pierhead. And adjacent to Redriff Estate was the pierhead.
Mm-hmm.
Been bombed during the war, so it was an open area. And I says, you know when you go up the pierhead and you look towards Greenwich, that's on the south part of the bend of the river.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'll tell you what I'm telling you, it'd be easier to show you. Jump on Dad's crossbar. So my dear sister Ivy, she jumped on the crossbar and I cycled up to the top of the pierhead, which is elevated a bit higher than Redriff Estate. And I said, can you see Greenwich Church? And she said, yes. I said, now can you see where the meridian is, you know, on the top of the hill at Greenwich? Yeah, that tower. Can you see that? Look, there's one coming now. And at that moment, Simon, I could see, though it was coming towards us, you could still see the reflection of the flame from its jet engine. Can you see that flame? Can you see it? And she went, yes, I can see it. Yeah, is that a doodlebug? I said, that's a doodlebug. No, don't worry. It'll take about a minute to get here. And she said, please take me home. And I used to be a bit of a torment as a as a boy, you
know. Brothers and sisters.
Okay, Ivy, wait, it get a bit closer. And I think I wanted to race the bomb.
Yeah.
That's taking torment to a different level.
And when the bomb was coming, and they flew comparatively low, Simon, it was probably an altitude of about 1,000 feet. That's quite low, you know, when you see an object coming along.
Yeah.
And it's a bomb. And as it was coming in the direction of Rotherhithe, I said to Ivy, when it was about half a mile away, okay, I'll take you home. And because it was all downhill into Redruth Estate, I cruised down at top speed and I flew into the flats. And Mum was at the street door. I always remember my mum calling, beckoning us, quick, 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 bomb's coming. And Mums knew how close bombs were, as we knew.
Yeah.
And instead of going straight to the street door, I wanted to pile on the agony. I had to do a left sweep and a right sweep to glide in nicely, you know. And as I'm doing it, the engine cut out. Sorry. And I frantically pedalled a bit quicker, but what I didn't expect was the clothesline that was going from left to right. In them days, people used to stick, I don't know where they got it from, nylon cord. It was from parachute cord. People used to be able to get it. But it was almost transparent.
Mm-hmm.
And it went from, as I say, from one line to the other. And it was sagging. And it was just a lovely height, just where my neck was. So as I'd done this glide round, this right-hand bend, I suddenly was arrested and I went sideways. And I could see the blood now going up, and I almost strangled myself. And I lowered the bike to the concrete floor. Ivy lightened, and because I knew I'd done wrong, I knew instantly I'd done wrong, and I was paying for, you know, what I'd done. My mum screaming, and then there was an almighty bang as the bomb dropped just quite close, just inside the docks. And because I knew I'd done wrong, I was trying to make an excuse and say, Mum, I've been wounded, you know. She took me to St. Olive's Hospital, where they stitched my neck, and the scar is still there.
Still on my neck.
And, of course, Dad's bike, the front wheel had buckled a bit. It was oval shaped now. And
I bet you're in trouble.
And I was out playing when Dad woke up. And this was a story that my mum used to tell me time and time again. We used to have a laugh afterwards. She said, Dad woke up and he walked out to the street door. People didn't bring bikes in them days. They used to always stand them up outside the street door. And Dad says, who's been on my bike? The wheel's all buckled. And she said, ah, please, please, Harry, don't jaw. Don't jaw, Tom. Jaw meaning don't tell him off.
Yeah.
Did you? I don't know if you know that expression. Yeah. Don't jaw, Tom. She said, he was only... He said, I'll tell you something. She said, all his necks cut. I had to take him up the hospital this afternoon. He went, his necks cut. He said, I'll tell you what. If Hitler don't kill him, he said, I'll end up bloody killing him.
Yeah.
That was Dad's words at that time. Yeah. And my mum always remembers that. If the Luftwaffe don't have him, I'll have him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's another memorable story that I've written about.
That is very good.
Yeah.
Tom, were you living in Bermondsey when the docks closed? And do you remember the effect that that had on the area when that happened?
Yes, I do, because for most of my life, though I went to art school from 1943 to about 1945, and I left art school probably prematurely. I shouldn't have left when I left, but I wanted to go to work, and they put me to a job in Oxford Street in a design firm. So I was hopefully going to take a career in art, but unfortunately, that's another story, I only lasted there about 3 months. And after 3 months, I was working in the docks with my brother, Joe.
So why did that happen then?
You want that story, do you?
Yeah, tell us that story. The
art school.
That's
I started working for a firm called Richard Lonsdale Hands. Three names, I think that constituted the name of the company. And it was in Oxford Street. And as a student, I suppose an apprentice artist, I was only 15 and a half, 16, something like that. My first job I can recall was a big block of plasticine was put in front of me, and I was told, give me your conception, give me your idea of an electric iron. Now, in them days, the old proverbial electric iron, you know, for ironing clothes, was a metal plate with two vertical posts and a handle. And because I loved aircraft at the time, I was fascinated, especially by the Spitfire, with its lovely cowling, you know, from the nose cone up to the cockpit. I designed my iron, my model, for 2 or 3 days I was working on this, and it looked just like the nose of a Spitfire. In fact, it looked just like a Morphy Richards iron of today. That was my conception in them days. And it took me 3 days to model this plasticine iron. And when I completed it on this working board, I said to my superior, what do I do with it now? And he says, you've got to take it in to show Mr. Hands your work. And I said, so what will happen? He said, well, you've got to take it in. He's got to examine it and see it. He said, walk over to his door, knock on the door, and wait for him to say enter. So I followed his instructions. I carried my model to the door, and believe it or not, I was conscious of about 8 to 10 people behind me, all looking at the situation. They anticipated something was going to happen. And I tapped on the door and I heard, come in. And I went in and I stood inside his door. He said, shut the door. And I shut the door with my foot, and he said, without looking up, and what have we got here? And I did think, as a South East London boy, well, if you open your eyes, you'll see what I've got here. I said, it's an electric iron, sir. Bring it across here, laddie. And I hate being called laddie, but he's the boss. So I slowly walked up to his desk, and he still hadn't looked at me yet. And he was looking at his paperwork in front of him, and he says, and what have you got there? I said, it's my conception of an electric iron, sir. And he says, without looking up, and how long have you been working on that, laddie? And as I was fuming, I said, 3 days, sir. And he says, and where is it? And I couldn't understand what he meant. It's here, sir. And he went, he leaned forward slowly without looking, and he put his hand on it, and he squashed it with his hand. My work of art was now just a pile of wet clay. And he said, try again, laddie. And I stormed out of his office. And when I got outside, they were all laughing. They all knew this, I think, what happened to me happened every time. It was just his way of making you think.
Yeah.
And I think for 3 more days, 4 more days, I worked on this iron, and I came up with basically the same design as I'd done previously. And I said to my boss outside, my charge hand, what do I do with this now? He says, what you did the other day. He might be a little bit better this time. He might be in a better mood. And I went into his office after knocking on the door and getting the command to come in, laddie. And I walked over to his desk this time, and he said, and what have we got here? Almost a repeat of what happened 3 days before. And this time, as his hand went out to find out where it was, I got the iron and I threw it down onto the floor. And I says, if you can do that, then so can I. And of course, I was without a job.
You were sacked immediately.
I was sacked immediately. Yeah. And of course, they understood outside, but they felt sad, but I did rebel against that.
Yeah.
So I went home to Mum. I was disappointed and I was afraid that Mum wouldn't think kindly of what I'd done, but I understood. And my brother, Joe, who worked in the docks, he was more of a, you know, the labouring type of lad. He got me a job in the docks and I was packing machinery to go overseas in Surrey Docks. I actually worked in the docks, not as a docker, but as a machine operator and packer. Then, of course, I went into the army in 1947, where I learned to drive. I was in the Royal Artillery, and I learned to drive up in North Wales, in Rhyl. And then I went on a driver mechanics course at Luton, quite close to where I live now, at Vauxhall Works, and I had my training there. And then in January 1948, sorry, in March 1948, after Tom was born, I was sent out to Libya in North Africa, where I did 18 months army service. And when I was sort of demobbed, as you call it, in 1949, September 1949, I had no trade to walk, you know, to start work as in any particular trade. And because I was a driver, I did become a coalman. I was a coalman for 4 weeks whilst we lived at Watford. Betty, my late wife, whilst I was in Libya, they'd moved from London to Watford, a new housing development in Watford. So when I come out of the army, of course, I naturally went to Watford, and the only work I could find was as a coalman.
Mm.
That was a bit of a disaster because I don't know if you know, Simon, when you're carrying coals on your back, you're inclined to get dirty.
Mm-hmm.
And after a day's work, you'd come home. Money was still quite tight. People didn't have plenty of money. And I was living with the in-laws anyway, Betty's mum and dad. And naturally, the first thing you do when you're black from top to bottom is to go and take a bath. Wasn't many showers in them days, I don't recall. And the bath would be full of precious hot water. And within seconds of me submerging my coal-stained body inside the water was black, so I had to empty it and fill the bath up. And it wasn't economically viable to continue this job.
Because of...
And then I took up lorry driving, and I virtually did lorry driving, heavy haulage, from 1950 right up until, well, the 70s, the late 70s, 1978, I think, I packed up lorry driving. And you asked a question about going in the docks or, you know, doing dock work. I used to frequent the docks quite regularly.
Mm-hmm.
When I was lorry driving, loading up in the docks and taking goods, provisions all over the country.
I
did that quite regularly for many years. And even when we moved from London, Betty and I, my first wife, to Peterborough, and then came across here where she died in Milton Keynes, and I met Joan, my second wife. We've been married 25 years. I did courier work, which was a much lighter work, and I did that for something like 10 years. Incidentally, I worked for Arrows Racing, the Formula One team in Milton Keynes.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah, I worked for them for 10 years.
Yeah.
Going around, picking up engines and gearboxes and that sort of thing.
That sort of thing.
So, yeah, I've been driving, and I still continue to drive, you know, privately.
Tom, can I take you back to... the closure of the docks and how you felt about that and how you thought that it affected the Bermondsey area?
Felt sad. I felt as though, you know, strange thing, where the Germans throughout the Second World War didn't stop the docks working, and then suddenly our own government, for what economic reasons or for whatever reasons, closed the docks, and it was part of our character. It was part of the character of people in Bermondsey, I think. I missed seeing the number of men signing on of the morning, you know, if I was around there at Surrey Docks. I missed that. I missed the element of shipping coming into the docks. Later on, I'm going to show you the painting I'm doing of Surrey Docks. It's quite a big painting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was saddened, as many, many people were saddened. And of course, after the docks closed, there was much unemployment too in Rotherhithe. I don't know what... well, I know some of my friends, I work for British Road Services, Bermondsey Group, which they, I don't know if you knew of British Road Services, it was a national company, that it was government owned. They took over many haulage companies and they were renamed British Road Services. They was usually red lorries with white letters, you know, and different towns, London had many depots, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, there were depots all over the country. And one used to go from one to the other, you know, after unloading, say, in Newcastle, you'd go across to Sunderland to pick a load up from another depot, you know, and bring it back to London. Yeah, it was quite a... And many, as I say, many dockers, I know for a fact, took up lorry driving as a living.
It's a popular way of going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, it wasn't just the docks that was closing in Bermondsey. You had all the food companies that had been there for years, Peak Friends, Cross and Blackwall. There was umpteen firms. Then you had the flour mills at Southwark Park Road near the Alwyn School. I don't know if the Alwyn School's still there.
And, I don't know if it is either. It doesn't
yeah.
Well.
Yeah. Yeah, Bermondsey's altered considerably in modern times. I probably wouldn't recognise around Rotherhithe Street at all. But I remember it because I've drawn it many, many times. It's there. They might have altered it physically, but it hasn't altered up here.
Why do you draw it? Is it why do you think you
nostalgia.
Do it? Nostalgia, you want to remember?
Yeah, I live in the past. I do live in the past, I think. Joan will tell you that. I'm always talking about the past. And, yeah, Rotherhithe. I was born and bred... I don't know if you know that St Olive's Hospital was a main confinement hospital for most people living in Rotherhithe. Guy's Hospital and St Olive's predominantly for Rotherhithe people, where people were born. Though they had four main wards in St Olive's, but the end one, the one closest to the river, was the maternity department. And am I proud to say that Michael Caine was born in the same ward?
There you go. It's claim to fame.
But like I told him, when I met him at Milton Keynes a few years ago, I happened to be talking, making a film up here, and I was driving by. I thought there'd been an accident, so I had to come out and dirty my nose, see if I could help. And Michael Caine was there. And I just said, "Hi, Mike." He said, "Hi. Who are you?" I said, "Who am I? I'm Tom Winter. Who are you?" And he, "Ha, ha, ha." And I said, "A lot of people don't know that." And he, I said, "I know you were born in Rotherhithe." And he went, "Yes, I was born in St Olive's Hospital." I said, "And so was I." He went, "Ooh." I said, "But you was born there in 1938. I was born there in 1929.
Yeah.
What about that?
Yeah.
So don't source your elders."
Yeah.
And he said, "I like it."
Yeah.
And that was Michael Caine.
Yeah, Michael Caine.
I think Tommy Steele might have been born in there. I don't know. And I don't know if you know, Matt Monroe, another famous great singer.
Yeah.
Born in Bermondsey or somewhere, Elephant and Castle, somewhere there.
Can you remember, you tell us about your experience of sheltering?
What, airway sheltering?
Yeah. All the sheltering that you did. You were bombed out twice, and then after that, what happened?
Well, Mum, after Gran's episode at Catford, and of course, when we went to Leicester, under the stairs. In Redriff Estate, there was a public shelter under the playing ground within the flats. But my mum would never use an air raid shelter anymore. Our front room was our air raid shelter, and I'll tell you why. My late brother, Joey, he was a wonderful DIY boy. He was always, and in them days, you know, when a wharf got bombed or timber yard got bombed, there was always plenty of surplus timber knocking around just for us kids to go and borrow, you know, we'd borrow a plank or two. No one used to take too much notice. But Dad says to Mum, Mum was putting sticky paper on the windows to stop the windows shattering when most windows during the war years, you'd see tape across the windows, crisscross, and this stopped the window from, you know, shattering and causing accidents. So Mum and Dad had popped away for a weekend. They had something to do, and Joey decided that he was going to make our front room bomb-proof. And he went into the docks with my assistants, and we carried some 4x2 timber, 4 inches by 2 inches, and something like 12-foot long lengths of timber. And they were nailed outside our front room window. I mean, physically nailed with 6-inch nails into the woodwork. And cut a long story short, I think they went up in 1941 and they was taken down on VE Day, Victory in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
On Victory in Europe, they was torn down and they helped make the bonfire.
That's a good symbol.
Yeah. And we had the electric light on in our front room almost constantly during sort of daylight hours, because we didn't know it was daylight outside until we walked out the street door. Our room was in perpetual darkness, you know, if the light wasn't on, through these bomb-proof windows.
Yeah.
So the answer to the shelter, our front room was our shelter. There was one sad happening with regard to our time in Redruth Estate. And I call this story Faith, Hope and Charity Humphreys, because that was the name of my dear friend Kenny Humphreys. This was his grandmother. Faith, Hope and Charity. What a lovely name. And I used to play in Ken's house. He lived on the top floor in Redruth Estate, on the other side of the estate. And I used to frequent his house quite regularly. And it was 7 o'clock one night in March 1941. And just before the air raid siren sounded, Kenny's young mum, Mrs. Humphreys, says, "Tom, pack the things up. We're going down to my mother's." And she used to always go to her mother's, Faith, Hope and Charity, that lived on the ground floor in Redruth. That was her airway shelter for the night, wherein she would take Kenny and his sister to stay with her mother. Incidentally, her husband was in the army, so he was away in the forces somewhere. This particular night, we came down the stairs before the airway sounded, and we walked past Granny's house. And as they went into their grandmother's house, I'll always recall Kenny saying, "See you tomorrow, Thomas." And I said, "Okay." And old Mrs. Humphreys, old, she was 56. And she waved out and says, "See you, Thomas." And I went indoors into my house, just about 50 yards further on in the flats. And the normal air raid started about 10 o'clock. And I think it was just close on midnight. Dad was out working in the flats as an air raid warden. And a bomber was overhead. And there was bombs getting closer and closer and closer to where we lived in Rotherhithe. They was dropping in Deptford. And suddenly a bomber was overhead, right above Redruth Estate. And I'll always remember them 5 or 6 whistles as a stick of bombs came down. And as we ducked, there was almighty bangs, and 5 of those bombs crashed into Redruth Estate.
Mm-hmm.
And nosy little Tommy, I had to go to the street door. Mum said, be careful. Be careful, you know, you won't get hurt. And as I opened the street door, I naturally looked to my left because that's the direction that the explosion seemed to come from. And all I could see was dense smoke. I could see a bit of flame somewhere in the flat somewhere. And Mum said, can you see Dad at all out there? And I said, no, but he'll probably be in a minute, moment, Mum. And then some airwave wardens went past my street door and says, go in, son, you get hurt. There's a lot of activity going on in there. And I shut the street door. And it was about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour later, that Dad popped in. He was black from top to bottom. And Mum says, hell, Harry, what's up? And he said, it's terrible out there. He said, a bomb's dropped in Elgar Street. A bomb's dropped near the Fidgets pub. A bomb's hit the flats, you know. He says, but so far, I don't think there's been anyone killed. He said, but there's a problem in the Humphreys. And when he said that, I looked up straight up and said, what, Kenny Humphreys' house, Dad? And he says, yeah, but don't worry. They're okay, he said. They've got Mrs. Humphreys out and Kenny and his sister, his young sister, but they're going in to get the old girl out because she's a bit infirm and she's in the corner of the room. And what actually happened, Simon, after they got the young Mrs. Humphreys out and the two children, she said, Mum's in there, but she can't move. She's in the corner of the room. As the four rescue workers went up the passageway to go into the front room, all the floor was dishevelled. Mm-hmm. It was up and down. The mat or the carpet in the middle was seemed to be going down a little bit, and they knew the floor was unsafe. And the elderly Mrs. Humphreys was in the corner, sitting on a chair. And these four rescue workers were going to take the perimeter of the room on the wall, you know, against the wall, because that was the only sound pathway. Stay where you are and we'll come and get you. And as the four men entered the front room and were halfway round, this is what onlookers actually saw and heard. They suddenly heard a terrible noise of an avalanche of earth departing. A big cavern opened up underneath them. And sadly, the four people went down and Mrs. Humphreys.
Oh, damn.
That was in Redford State. And Dad says, but someone's going in to, you know, to rescue him. But when Dad came in the second time, about 20 minutes later, he told us what had happened. And I'll always remember the Sunday morning in March 1941. It was a lovely sunny day. About 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, and they were still digging to try to reach the five people. The hole must have been quite deep. And there was a call. They found one. Yeah, they found one. And there was crowds and crowds of people all in the square. You know, of course, you're all clear had gone by this time. And eventually, after about half an hour, they brought up the five bodies. And they were still sound as people, but they'd all been suffocated, they all died. And that was one of the biggest tragedies in Rotherhithe, you know, in Redriff Estate, that I recall. And I've written about that because, you know, in life today, when I read sometimes or hear on television of the honours list, and we're coming back, say, to Michael Caine or Tommy Steel, Michael Caine in particular. So Michael Caine, he gets a knighthood for his services to the public with his music. And good luck to him, okay, but he's made a hell of a lot of money out of it. And he gets a knighthood. He gets respected and called Sir Michael Caine. And yet there were four men that gave their lives in the Second World War. They were knights to me. My brother was a knight of the realm, but they don't get even thought of.
No.
So this thing of knighthood, and they don't even get an MBE, you know, And that do dishearten me as an older person from London, from this country, that I think sometimes...
it's putting glory in all the wrong places, isn't it?
Yeah, and bravery is bravery. Yeah. And they don't do it intentionally. I mean, when you want to be a music star, you do it intentionally because this is your career. When people spontaneously and instantly go in to rescue someone, they're not thinking of their career, they're not thinking of themselves, they're thinking of someone else. And they don't even get a mention. But I've paid tribute because I've written a story about that. Yeah. And I would love you in some way, even if you get it recognised, not from my story, but from the people that died. And I've written that and named them. Yeah, that is where I get, Joan will tell you, I get very, very sad sometimes when I'm doing work. I'm quite an emotional person, but I do think of that many people don't get recognised for their deeds too.
Yeah.
If you were, what do you think you'd like to pass on? What do you think you learned from your wartime experiences? Would you like to pass on to perhaps a boy or a girl who is 11 or 12 now?
What, now?
Yeah.
Well, I do put at the end of my story, it's only a pity that children of today and people of today, my children's, my grandchildren's generation of today, can never know and will never know the comradeship that existed amongst ordinary people of Bermondsey, in particular because I was a Bermondsey boy during the Second World War. There was a comradeship that will never, I don't think it'll ever be seen again.
Yeah.
People were that much more friendly to each other and helpful to each other. Nowadays, it's a world of plenty and people are quite selfish. The more they get, the more they want. That is true, isn't it?
Totally. Me and Simon were talking about it on the way here a little bit. And I was saying I've recently been to India and people just help each other so much. And that's, you know, that family and that community is still so much part of the culture.
Yeah.
And I think for some families it is, but it's really not it's not the norm anymore, is it?
No. In the Second World War, even when people were, some was down on finances, someone had always said, don't worry about it, I'll help you out, or food. They shared what they had. Not only with food, but with their property. If someone got bombed out, you know, come in, you know. The door was always open. It could happen, it might happen even today's generation if they were subjected to it. We don't know.
Sure.
I think they possibly would do. But I'm saying the children, they just can never know. You got to live for it to understand it. And that's why a lot of my stories, I do end up with emotional words, you know, explaining that. Yeah, explaining my feelings. Would you like another cup of tea?
I was going to say, shall we stop recording there? Thank you so much for your time, Tom.
I hope it's come over okay. And...